This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of February the 20th, 2017. Current Federal Tax Developments is brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPE, a division of the Los Calzo Institute, and your state societies of CPAs. This week, we're going to get to the developments that come under the title this week of Silence is Confusing. We'll take a look at a number of current developments for this week. First, I want to start out looking at yet another phishing email warning from the IRS. The Sixth Circuit panel decides the IRS went too far in a substance over form attack on a transaction. A practicing dentist was actually found to be a real estate professional in a case this week. The IRS quietly issued a notice on silent returns to the tax preparation industry that got out this week and caused a bit of confusion. And finally, we have an estate that was found to have reasonable cause for late filing a return based on reliance on the erroneous advice from an attorney as to what the filing deadline was for the estate. Well, we're getting down to now the last chance to pick up your update for industry. And this is your last chance for those of you in Ohio or those of you who are going to participate in the webcast. On February 24th, the Ohio Society will be broadcasting a federal tax update for industry put on by Butch Olson. If you want to sign up for that, there's still a few days here as we publish this week to get signed up and get there if you're going to be in the Columbus area or you're going to be able to attend the webcast. If you want to know information about that, go to the Ohio Society's website to sign up. And, you know, that's basically now this will finish up our CPE year for 2016-2017. And now we'll get ready for the 2017-2018 year coming up as soon as we get through the following tax season, which, of course, is why most of you probably are here listening to this. And unfortunately, some of you may be listening, you know, sitting after having worked way too many days this week. But, hey, the fun's just starting. So let's get started with our first development for the week. And this is the IRS has issued yet another phishing email warning. This came out in IRS News Release IR 2017-39, was issued on Friday, the 17th of February. This particular phishing email is actually going after, which we see happen in cases like this, I should say, it's going after a frustration that some CPAs are voicing right now. You're hearing a lot of CPAs voicing frustration that due to the heightened security requirements being imposed on tax software this year, that they're discovering things are happening like you're being logged out of your tax software every half hour. And if you try too many times to log in to your software or let's say your software website that's related, for instance, for things like releasing returns for electronic filing, if you try to get in there too many times with the wrong password, you're locked out. Now, many CPAs have run into trouble with this. In fact, some of the tax software providers have noted that one of the reasons why you may be having trouble getting some of your technical questions answered this year is because of all the time they're spending on the phone with preparers who have managed to lock themselves out of their accounts. So based on this, it doesn't take the fraudsters very long to figure out something like this is going on. And now we're seeing emails come out that claim to come from your tax software provider that have the subject of access locked. And what they hope to do, they'll tell you in the email that your tax software account's been suspended due to errors in your security details. And it asks professional to address the issue by using an unlock link provided in the email, where, of course, you will give various credentials that can be used to do various nasty things, presumably one of which will be file false returns using your credentials. That's the big problem. Now, the catch here is that these phishing emails most often rely upon making sense in context. And what these people know is if they blast these out to enough preparers, enough CPAs, they're going to get some CPAs who have just recently managed to lock themselves out of whatever access they need to something. This email then pops up shortly after they've locked themselves out, and they're going to react by thinking, oh, this is what this is. I need to click here, and this will get me back in the system. Be very, very careful. Now, I think the IRS did a wonderful job of putting the note out because we need to know these things are coming. They did not such a wonderful job in their statement about what you should be doing. To quote them, they said that the Security Summit Partners, which includes the IRS, state tax agencies, and the nation's tax community, remind tax professionals and taxpayers never to open a link or an attachment from a suspicious email. Okay, that sounds great, except here's the problem. If I consider an email suspicious, well, I'm not likely to open a link or click an attachment. You know, and I think everybody's pretty aware right now that there are these problem emails. We're all being flooded with them. The problem is not a suspicious email. It's an email that you don't believe is suspicious when you click on those links. It's an unfortunate fact of life, but at this point in time, the only safe thing to do with emails is never to click on a link in an email, because you can never tell for sure. Well, we'll say in most cases, you cannot tell for sure. There are technical ways that you could research it, but it's beyond the capabilities of most CPAs and most other users to really figure these things out. Those of you who know how, fine, I understand that, but you got to realize there's a lot of people out there that don't. If you click that link, you know, you're just likely to be taken, and you're most likely going to click the link in an email that makes sense in context and want something done right now, which is this handles both sides of that, and it's going to happen during tax season. The danger is we're going to see more of these, and yes, as things develop, as developments take place, as frustrations arise, these guys are going to adapt to try to make their emails look. So the problem is they've adapted to make their emails look not suspicious, and that's where our big problem comes. So you got to just be very careful out there at this point. Our next development up. We have a case that is a reversal of a tax court case. This is a case of Summa Holdings, Inc. versus Commissioner. This comes from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. It's case number 16-1712, and it was issued on February the 16th. Now, the Sixth Circuit panel was dealing with a case where the tax court had found that a domestic international sales corporation Roth IRA transaction was actually just a disguised method of stuffing excess contributions into a Roth IRA. The tax court had come to this conclusion based on an IRS theory, and the court agreed with, that based on substance over form, the reality of this transaction was that they were just trying to get more money in the Roth IRA than they could otherwise get. The problem the Sixth Circuit found, they end with an interesting quote in the case, which is what's going to explain how they look at this. Is the court said the last thing the federal court should be doing is rewarding Congress's creation of an intricate and complicated Internal Revenue Code by closing gaps in taxation whenever that complexity creates them. The court found that, in fact, the taxpayers had used both the Roth IRA and the DISC in a way Congress had intended, or at least in a way that Congress had designed, and because of that, it's up to Congress to fix the problem. Now, for those of you not aware of how domestic international sales corporations work, it was designed, as the court told us, and this, the court will explain this, it's in the materials that we have for download on our website, to incentivize companies to export their goods. It would defer and lower taxes on export income. And the exporter avoids the corporate income tax by paying the domestic international sale corporation commissions of up to 4% of gross receipts or 50% of net income from qualified exports. That special corporation, the DISC, pays no tax on its commission income up to $10 million and may hold on to the money indefinitely, though the shareholders have to pay annual interest on their shares of deferred tax liability. Now, what happens here, though, is instead of holding it, it could distribute that cash as a dividend. Now, of course, if it does, the shareholders would pay tax on the dividends. Obviously, today, that would be at the qualified dividend rate, which would be lower. But it didn't take people long to figure out that you could do that sort of thing, pay the commission and run it straight through then to the shareholders. If the shareholder happened to be a tax-exempt organization, there was no tax at all being imposed. And if that tax-exempt organization was an IRA, well, we don't get the perfect no-tax situation. But what happens is the IRA ends up greatly deferring the tax with no payment of interest because we send the commissions into the Domestic International Sales Corporation. The Domestic International Sales Corporation, owned by the IRA, pays out a dividend immediately to get rid of that cash. That causes a dividend to be paid or to be picked up by the IRA, which then can use those funds to invest in whatever it wants. That allows a way of, obviously, you get 4% of sales, at least sales that go overseas, can effectively be diverted into the IRA. Well, Congress kind of noticed that problem. In 1989, they plugged that up by saying that if a tax-exempt organization essentially own shares in a domestic or national sales corporation, the dividends would represent unrelated business taxable income, and it had to pay tax at the corporate rate. Obviously, now that's no longer such a wonderful deal. Except Congress did that in 1989. They came back 8 years later in 1997. Congress enacted Roth IRAs. Now, of course, with a Roth IRA, we're still going to pay the unrelated business income tax. But what's going to end up happening is we're not going to have to pay tax ever again. So we get one level of tax. Remember, for paying this out of a, you know, if it would have been subject to at least a, you know, the same rate as a corporation or higher, had it stayed in the selling company, then realistically, we just pay the tax at the in the exempt organization or in the structure we had here. We actually had the DISC was owned by another corporation, which then was owned by the IRA. And that allowed the corporation to simply file the tax return instead of having to do an unrelated business income return on the IRA, because then the next dividend would just be a taxable dividend to the IRA or effectively no tax. So Roth IRAs could be used. And the neat thing about that is, let's say, you know, I have this income. I could obviously, if I'm doing a lot of exporting, put far more than the maximum IRA Roth IRA contribution into the account. And even better, if I could establish a Roth IRA, I could do that even if my income was too high to allow for contributions to a Roth IRA. And I could establish one by simply rolling over, let's say, $100 into a Roth IRA from a regular IRA, you know, pay the tax on that, and then suddenly have this Roth that could then supposedly buy the stock in the domestic international sales corporation and then receive the income. The IRS, of course, claimed, well, that was too good to be true. They argued that based on substance over form, what the taxpayer's real intent was to make excess contributions. And the tax court agreed. But this particular panel did not agree with that. This panel claims that, in fact, this is going a step too far for substance over form. They don't have problems, they claim, if we look at the economic roots, where the transaction fails to capture the economic reality and would distort the meaning of the code in the process. But in this case, a domestic and national sales corporation is an allowed entity. The Roth IRA is allowed to own shares in a corporation. Congress had set up rules that basically made it clear that regular IRAs could own shares in this thing, though they'd be penalized for it. Congress has not done any similar penalties for Roth. The court said it's just a step too far for the IRS to impose the penalty here. Now, need to give you a bit of a warning here. This is a Sixth Circuit case only. The court acknowledged that other courts have read it more broadly. In fact, even acknowledged that other Sixth Circuit cases have read this substance over form transaction broadly enough to apparently cover a situation like this. They said they were all fact specific, so they're trying to differentiate this holding from the others. So it's not clear how far this would go, and it's also not clear it will go anywhere outside the Sixth Circuit. But it is important to note that in this case, the IRS was slapped down a bit on their ability, on their attempt to try to fix a problem, which the court felt, and probably correctly, was a problem that was created by the U.S. Congress, and that the court decides that the courts nor the IRS should fix the problem. It's up to the gang on Capitol Hill to fix it. Next up, we actually have a case here in the case of Zeringer versus et al. Versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2017-34, issued on February the 13th. We have a case where a practicing dentist was found to be a real estate professional. Now, this is a little bit unusual because we've had lots of cases in the past where taxpayers who have a job other than in real estate have tried to argue they're a real estate professional, and almost without exception, those cases have crashed and burned because there is a problem. To be a real estate professional, the taxpayer must have more than 750 hours of services in real property trades or business in which he actively participates. Okay, fine. That's no problem. But also more than one half of the personal services performed in trade or business in which he materially participates must also be real property trade or businesses. That second prong is where we get in trouble. Because let's say you're a CPA and you know you're working. We all know how tax season works and adds up the hours. It's going to take a lot of real estate hours to get more hours than you had in your CPA practice. So it's going to be very difficult for you as a practicing CPA to be a real estate professional. Now we have here a practicing dentist, but there is a little bit of unusual couple of unusual items in this case. This gentleman, you know, Mr. Zerendiger, and I'm sure I'm blowing his name. I apologize to the doctor for that. But his spouse was also a dentist, Dr. Deeney. Now, the two of them changed off days or hours that they worked. So they effectively were running one practice, but they were running it by sharing different times of the day or different days of the week. So they each went in, did their work. The tax court found a couple things. Number one, the very important thing was the doctor was a believable witness. He had detailed records of the time he had spent on the rental properties. And when he testified at trial, he had detailed memories of what he did on the various days. He could explain things in detail. A big problem we have with a lot of clients is they kind of vaguely try to remember what they did and they write up things after the fact. And of course, when questioned in detail, they contradict and things fall apart. This doctor did not do that. Number two, though, they also was able to show that he could document his hours in the dental practice. The court found that he clearly had more than 1,000 hours in real estate, and he clearly had less than 1,000 hours in the dental practice, so he met that test. Now, the IRS had conceded that he would qualify as purely participating in each rental because he met the substantially all tests found at Regulation 1.469-5TA2. So he did substantially all of the activities, all the participation in the activities of all individuals, including individuals who are not owners of interest. Now, you may need to be careful there because the IRS didn't actually challenge that in this case. My guess is if they dug a little deeper, they might have been able to challenge on some of the rentals because it's not apparent. It appears the doctor did not make the election to group all of his rentals together. Had he done that, it would have been a simple slam dunk because all of them would have gone well over 500 hours based on what the court found. It's an interesting case because it does show it's not impossible for somebody who has another, let's say a professional to qualify as a real estate professional, somebody who is a professional in a non-real estate area. But it also is very important to understand the very specific facts of this case. And it was very important to understand that it's not going to be easy to meet that test. But in this case, the taxpayer met the test. Next up, the IRS managed to try to do something quietly. And by the end of the week, we had confusion reigning. But we can probably explain what's happening here pretty easy. This came out, actually, what we're going to give you a citation to here is the IRS website article on individual shared responsibility provision that was updated on February the 15th. It referenced the executive order issued, Executive Order 13765, issued by the president on January the 20th. That's the executive order that you may all remember was signed, you know, immediately after inauguration that dealt with the Affordable Care Act. What the IRS announced, they told software vendors, apparently on February 9th, that the IRS was going to change how they had announced they were going to process electronically filed returns this year. The IRS had announced prior to this tax season that they were changing. In the past, you could electronically file a return if your software allowed you to do so, which most of ours didn't, that failed to answer the questions about healthcare. So they didn't indicate they had healthcare coverage all year, and they didn't indicate any exception, and they also didn't indicate, you know, what penalty would be due. That's what the IRS refers to as a silent return. The IRS had announced that beginning with the 2016 returns, they would not accept returns filed that didn't answer those questions and didn't do something on the return with that. It would be a reject for electronic filing. Now, last year, they would accept the returns. That doesn't mean you wouldn't get correspondence later from the IRS and potentially be subjected to the additional tax and potentially the interest, et cetera, that would be due on the assessment. And they could offset that against refunds. We have all kinds of things that could happen. So all those things could still happen, but they would have processed the return. Now they're saying they wouldn't process it. Well, since the executive order, Section 2 of that order said, to the maximum extent permitted by law, the Secretary of Health and Human Services and the heads of all other executive departments and agencies with authorities and responsibilities under the Act being the Affordable Care Act, shall exercise all authority and discretion available to them to waive, defer, grant exemptions from, or delay the implementation of any provision or requirement of the Act that would impose a fiscal burden on any state or a cost, fee, tax penalty, or regulatory burden on individuals, families, healthcare providers, health insurers, patients, recipients of healthcare services, purchasers of health insurance, or makers of medical devices, products, or medication. The IRS concluded that based on that order, that it was not appropriate for them to change the processing from last year, because that would have imposed an additional condition for electronic filing. They made it very clear on their website that essentially they were not yet, had not made any decisions yet about what other relief, if any, would be granted under these rules. As the IRS notes on this page, the legislative provisions of the ACA law are still in force, still changed by Congress. Congress is reportedly working on those changes, but they've hit a few snags, shall we say, getting there. And taxpayers remain required to follow the law and pay what they may owe until that law is changed by Congress, or I should add parenthetically, until the IRS grants some sort of relief, which they have not yet done. Now, a lot of preparers got upset or got worked up because this broke out when Drake, one of our software vendors, actually notified its customers that they were going to turn on an option to allow this to happen. Well, of course, nobody aside from the software vendors knew that anything had come out. So suddenly Drake's announcement that the IRS was going to allow returns to be filed without this information caused tons of speculation about what all this meant. Well, as we say, the IRS updated their website. And what becomes clear right now is it actually doesn't mean a whole lot yet. It may mean a whole lot later, but as of right now, if you file a silent return, we keep all these things off, if your software will let you, and most software will not let you do that unless they until they update their software, like Drake did, to allow that to happen. But if you file that silent return, what may very well happen is you may get correspondence. Or my concern would be the IRS may come up with some relief, but you'd have to do something on the return, which of course you didn't do on the return you filed with silent disclosure, you know, a silent return, because you didn't know you had to do it. So as of right now, I would say that if a client wants to file this way and your software allows it, I would certainly have a long discussion with the client about why the best thing to do might be to wait, because now that the Treasury Secretary has been confirmed, hopefully we'll get some guidance that's a lot clearer than this on what we're supposed to do, and then we could just do whatever we're supposed to do. But if the client wants to file this way, then some people ask, well, can I sign the return? I understand a theoretical argument why you'd say you couldn't, but I think the executive order gives you at least a reasonable basis for signing a return with nothing on it. But if you do that, you've got to warn the client that they could get correspondence. We might need to file an amended return to comply with whatever the IRS decides we're supposed to do to get waivers from the fee. And I would tell the client, quite honestly, that, you know, if you do that, it's going to cost you money when you come back in, because my advice right now is to sit tight. If you don't want to sit tight and wait, then any future correspondence, any future problems were caused by the fact you didn't wait. And I'm not doing any work for you for free to fix those problems. Any work I do there is going to be charged, just kind of the way I would view it. So for the moment, as I say, keep your eye on this. We certainly expect additional guidance to come. But we have, what we have right now is not sufficient to say that no penalty will be applied. We may very well get that. I suspect we may get something very close to that, but we don't have it yet. Finally, we have the case of the estate of Hake versus United States. This came from the United States District Court for the Middle District of Pennsylvania. This is case number 1:15-CV01382. This opinion was issued on February the 13th. We've discussed many times before that normally a taxpayer cannot get out of a late filing penalty by claiming they relied on their attorney or CPA to, let's say, get an extension or to get the return filed timely. The IRS position has been, and you know, we've continued that. If you remember, we had this a couple of years ago, the case of Vaughn versus Commissioner, where it turns out his advisors told him they'd filed returns, but they actually hadn't, and Mr. Vaughn was still stuck with having to pay the penalties, etc., because he had a personal responsibility to get the return filed. Well, in this case, an estate had an issue here. It was an estate. The executor retained a lawyer to assist with tax matters. This is not this case. This was talking about an earlier case, Boyle, where the U.S. Supreme Court found that you couldn't do it. In the case of Boyle, he relied on the attorney's instruction. He did that, and he checked with the attorney due to a oversight. The lawyer overlooked the matter of the filing date for his master calendar, and so he didn't advise him to file timely. In that case, the court found, sorry, guy, you're on the hook. But in this case, we had a case of an estate where the executor brought in attorneys. The attorneys sought an extension of time to file the return and pay the taxes. They hadn't actually done a whole lot of this work, apparently, in the past. They'd never really done this, asked for an extension of time to pay the taxes, and mistakenly thought that an extension of time to pay the tax, would also be an extension of time to file the 706. Well, it's not. The 4768 is only good for 6 months. However, the executors, based on the advice of the attorney that told them the due date to file the return, actually filed the return prior to the due date. Now, they paid the tax by that date, but the problem was now their estate tax return was late, and so the IRS wanted a penalty of just under $200,000. Not a small amount of money. The IRS said, well, this is a non-delegatable duty, and they based that on the Boyle case I mentioned earlier. The district court here noted that other courts have applied Boyle that broadly. Specifically, there's a case of West versus Kosakin from the Eastern District of Virginia that held that it's an absolute duty and there is no excuse whatsoever for late filing. Or I shouldn't say no excuse. They're just, you cannot blame your counsel, your attorney, or your CPA for causing you to file the return late by giving you bum advice as to a date. There also is the Ninth Circuit case of Knapp versus United States from 2013, where the Ninth Circuit also agreed that this simply, it's not something that can be reasonable cause for relying on the attorney. Calendars can be looked, you can look at calendars and you can make sure things are done by due dates. The court found that that was totally non-delegatable. However, in this case, the court found that because counsel had given them a due date and they had filed by the due date, they followed the Third Circuit's basically background in this area, what the Third Circuit had held before, which is where this case would go to appeal. And the Third Circuit, in the case of Thornton, had specifically held that if you give bum advice as to the due date of a return, we had experienced counsel, and the court noted this due date was a complex matter. It was complex enough it confused the attorneys. So the taxpayer, they said, had a right to rely on that advice. Because they had relied on that advice, they had attempted to comply with the law, they do not owe the late filing penalty. Well, we're into tax season now. And yes, April 18th really is coming eventually down the line. But as we all know, it seems a lot further out at this point than 2 months from now. Or just a little under 2 months from now, we should say. Well, hopefully you can manage your stress without doing too many things or pulling out too much hair. But remember, your state societies are there. They all have various resources that can be helpful this time of year. I'll note that while we don't have a lot of live CP going on this time of year, if you do have some special odd little situation coming up, almost all of the state societies have arrangements with various providers that can give you focus CPE on a short, let's say, 2 hour, 3 hour focus CPE that's in a self-study form that could be very useful if you run into some unusual situation that you feel you need to brush up on. And also don't forget, once tax season is over, go back and check with your state society for getting your training for next year to hopefully reduce our stress coming next year. Oh yeah, don't forget, next year, that's a year when suddenly, January 1st, 2018, that's when those new partnership audit rules are going to start taking effect. And so you're going to have to get yourself all nicely de-stressed to talk with your partnerships when you're filing the 17 returns to ask them if they fix things for 18. So you need to have some, you got to pick up some training on that. There's all those other things. Be sure to take a look at your state society. We'll have resources that you can take advantage of during tax season and then come back here and take a look at their resources for your training after tax season. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of February 20th, 2017. Be sure to catch our updates posted on our website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, where we'll post our articles as things happen during the week. Also on that website, on the weekly developments link, you'll find for this particular broadcast, you'll be able to download a PDF that has the articles from this week's materials. So it's a 10-page PDF, gives you more material, more description on the cases we discussed. You can also send questions and comments to me at edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, or you can follow me on Twitter. My handle there is at Ed Zollars. Well, have a good week as all those brokerage 1099s start pouring in. And we look forward to talking with you next week here on current federal tax developments.